And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hey everybody, it's Dean Haglund here in the office of the Rational Exuberant Time of the Historic Horror of downtown Los Angeles, in the world of the Art Deco Wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And with your co-host and mine, sitting right here, there he is, ladies and gentlemen, Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
It's this guy.
Look at that guy right there.
I am
sitting right there.
Phil Lairness, your co-host, your co-pilot.
Your co-host with the mo-host. What? No, that's not right.
Oh, my goodness. We're exhausted. How can we be so exhausted starting a show?
I don't know if there's an environmental toxin with all the construction going around here, as downtown Los Angeles is in a building boom the likes it's never seen. But there's something that is affecting the throat and the energy, and it's not a cold. It seems to be some bizarre environmental industrial poison they're using on one of the work sites in a three-block radius from here, because I've been having a fun time of it as of late.
Well, you know, I actually have a name I believe that scientifically might be appropriate. Like you were saying, you don't know if it's a bug, you don't know what to call it, but I think there is actually a scientific name for what you're describing for something in the environment that's sapping all your energy from you.
Yes.
And it's called Furious 7.
Ah.
But we'll talk about movies later on in the show.
That does sap my energy.
You know what we have not done?
What?
In so long.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, why not start? Because you spent 84 hours on plane flights.
Right.
So I'm convinced that you're going to have some answer to this question. What are you or have you been reading?
Oh, my gosh. If you're talking about the 84 hours of plane flight, you're thinking I read the Fijian Air travel guide from cover to cover. I know all about surfing and Fiji water and how it gets to our shelves here in North America.
It involves slavery, right? And it involves a poppy. Look, Fiji water is my favorite water. And it comes from one of the last dictatorships on Earth where 80% of the population is denied access to fresh water. Probably not in the travel guide.
Not in the travel guide. It said more it was a cooperative that everyone participates and shares the profits.
And how do you get people to cooperate, really?
A massive dictatorship. I did not
Hey,
know
am
that,
I in
actually.
One? Am I in one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why, are you a little quiet?
I just wanted to I think I was a little loud, and
No. Okay, so what I did bring with me is the history of Scandinavian monarchy called The Scepter and the Cross, written by a Norwegian historian, translated into English.
Okay. And it covered all the Scandinavian lands?
All the Scandinavians, the Danes, the Norwegians, how it divided itself from the time of, I think it goes as far back as 200 AD. And I'm learning all about Olaf the Great and numerous other Danish kings, hoping to get up to my great, 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 great grandfather.
Oh, here we go again.
Eric the 14th.
Wow.
Yes, brother to King John the Melancholy of the Vasa line. So King Vasa.
Oh,
of course,
Vasa water, by Vasa. The way. Also terrific.
And not done through a dictatorship cooperative. So
I feel like my levels are really hot. Are they not really hot? No, they're okay.
No, they're really good. That's really hot. That was me. But there, now they're really
We're doing
good.
An audio test on the air. I love this. This is terrific.
I know.
Okay.
What we do before we go on the air.
That's you love this history of the your ancestral...
Ancestral home,
Ancestral
yes.
manse.
Yes, ancestral manse. Well, it's funny that, you know, they're once they found out that there's a personal genetic lineage to, though we are the illegitimate offspring of Eric
the 14th
and the offspring. So technically it was the stablemate and the king.
I wish I had like a Mr. T audio thing right now, because every time, I mean, you know, every week, as you know, I've been almost every day, I've been making available at chillpackhollywood.com and on our blog talk radio site a show from the archives, a show from the vaults, because when we went independent several years ago, our good friends at Farpoint Media wiped out everything that we'd ever done. And
yes,
thanks for having been here.
So you don't exist.
So then, so it's taken a long time for us to get to this point. Our hosts at Blog Talk Radio now have made it very simple for us to make these shows available again. And so every day I've been doing it. We have 35 shows left that are not available out of 411 shows.
That's amazing.
After last week, only 35. Are not available, and I would imagine that in half of those, you mention your relation to Eric the 14th.
Really? I don't think that's true. I haven't talked about it in about 2 years on
the
show.
I don't know. I believe, first of all, it's the first thing you introduce. We had people in our movie, The Truth Is Out There,
right,
introduce themselves to us by saying, the first thing you need to know about me is that I'm an alien-human hybrid.
Right.
And you met them, and we fell in love with them.
Yes.
The first thing, certainly maybe the second thing after I'm TV's Dean Hagland,
is Eric the 14th.
Illegitimate offspring of Eric the 14th. I mean,
well, that's
you even told Alex Jones that on his show.
Think about that. How great does that look on your business card? Seriously.
Not as good as your old business card that said you met me while I was drunk.
That's still the case.
So, well, that's interesting. But you do love that. You love history, but you love that the history from that particular part of the world. And I'm becoming more and more intrigued by it after rejecting it for most of my life, even though much of my heritage comes from there.
Absolutely.
But it is kind of fascinating, the history there. And kind of a cradle of civilization.
A little bit, because they weren't just nomadic pillaging Vikings. They were also agricultural pioneers and going to Dublin, Iceland, Greenland, even Nova Scotia.
When my great-great-great-grandfather, Eric Peterson, who would change his name to Larinus because he wanted to get his mail... he moved from Norway directly to Borup County, Minnesota.
As one does.
Because it was similar farming terrain.
Yes,
he was a farmer.
Farmer. And so, similar weather conditions.
Anything else? Anything else you've been reading?
I got that. And, you know, I'm still trying to get through that Snowman detective novel by Bo Erickson. It's a tough read.
Is that also a Scandinavian writer?
That's a Scandinavian crime writer as well. And it's a, you know, dark days where the sun goes down at 2 p.m. and, you know, sort of that. So I'm going through the Scandinavian historical context first before I get back to my Scandinavian crime novel.
I see.
Yes.
I finally finished after maybe 10 months. I'd have to go back and see when I first mentioned this book on the show. But a novel called What to Keep. It's 280 pages, is
all,
by Rachel Klein, and it is set in three different sections, and it predominantly focuses on a single working mother, I think she's a neuroscientist,
Kate.
And her young daughter, and then their relationships with the other people in their lives, obviously.
Right.
And then after the first section, it flashes forward to that young daughter now in her 20s, living in Los Angeles, and the mother still living back home. And having become remarried. Then the final is in New York 20 years further on. And the young daughter is now middle-aged and a playwright in New York. And her mother, who has, with her second husband, moved to New York to take a faculty position there, is facing life in retirement. And I found that I stayed away from this book and would never read more than a few pages because I was so terrified of it ending. And
because you enjoyed the world so much?
I just fell in love with these characters so much. And so sure enough, finally when I finished it, final few pages, I am sobbing uncontrollably, not just because of how satisfying the destination for these characters is, and it certainly was, but also because
you're gonna miss them.
I'm gonna miss them, and you know, there's part of me that wants to reach out to this Rachel Klein and see if there's if the film rights are available.
Ah.
And you know, I mean, I don't know if I may be too old, but you know, Boyhood, right?
Oh, right. You're going to follow them for...
This is something that follows 40 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Less than 40 years, but 30 years.
Start right now.
With different actresses.
Yeah.
I mean, you could always recast if you have to.
Yeah, yeah.
But wouldn't that be interesting?
Wouldn't that be something?
Age into it. And you could shorten it a little bit maybe by having cheating the age a little bit. I may be exaggerating. I think maybe she was a preteen, but she might have been, the young girl might have been 10, 11, 12 when it started.
Right.
And she may be mid to late 30s by the end. So it may only be 20-something years, in which case I got time to pull this thing
Yes,
off.
You do.
But it's really beautiful.
Wow. And what do they keep? Is that ever answered?
And isn't that interesting? What to keep and what to let go of? And the whole thing is about letting go. And I had the hardest time letting go.
So it's you failed really from the lesson of the book.
No, but maybe I did, finally. But also, it's everybody at their own time. It takes everybody their own time to let go.
Right.
I'm now reading, because I'm going to eschew the documentary altogether, at least until I've read the book. I'm reading Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief by Lawrence Wright.
Yes.
Which has just been turned into a very much ballyhooed documentary by Alex Gibney. But I heard about how the documentary has lawyers all over it. Like 138 lawyers were assigned to this. And so much of what's in the book is not in the movie.
Ah.
And I want the full accounts.
Right.
Not that necessarily they are, as we know, right? Maybe some of the accounts that are given by these people are not factual in some ways. But as we know from, again, having made Truth Is Out There, when you let someone speak, they're always speaking truth, even if that truth is about themselves.
Right.
And even if it's revealing to you how their perception works.
The story we tell.
Even if it's not factual doesn't mean that it's a lie.
Right.
Which is a willful disregard of the facts.
Right.
But you learn about people by actually getting to see themselves in their words or by reading their words. And so it's important to me to get to read the unabridged
narrative.
Accounts.
Right. And the narrative of how that's told, right?
Yeah.
Because the story, how you tell the story is as important as the story itself.
Yeah.
So.
And also, I'm not sure in a documentary if I could get the, you know, there's this great thing, right, about why is reading important? Well, one of the reasons that reading is important is because what we find is that people who read develop at an earlier age and to a greater degree empathy.
Right.
And which is in real short supply.
It sure is.
And I read this book and I feel empathy for the Scientologists. I feel compassion for what they may be feeling, which is a sense of being under attack,
right,
for their beliefs.
For their beliefs.
For their being bullied, even. Now, don't get me wrong.
Their techniques.
Much of their techniques and much of what they are responsible for, and again, much of what has been done, in fairness, in the name of this religion that L. Ron Hubbard started, after, though, these things were being done after he was dead.
Right.
Which, again, is, you know, don't throw out the baby Christ with the bathwater because of what's been done in his name.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
So, boy, interesting to be talking about this after Easter.
I know.
But it is fascinating because if I can find this place of empathy to move beyond judgment while still holding the reality of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, gosh darn it, we can learn something from anyone's belief system.
Absolutely.
That might apply. I go, well, you know, that's a good idea. Boy, that idea finds its antecedent in Siddhartha or in Freud or...
Which was the whole science of the mind in the first place.
Right.
It's like there's all of these antecedents that you can put together and remove from ancient text, as it were.
Hubbard always would stress... and Scientology stresses this to this day, though they stress it, I believe, as a recruitment and induction tool. But nevertheless, they stress what Hubbard stressed, what the spy that got him interested in Freud's psychoanalysis in the 1920s, a U.S. spy, stressed, which is a quote from Siddhartha, the Buddha, you know, if it's not true for you, it's not true. Which is fascinating, right? Because it's not Dianetics, you know, in Scientology, it's not supposed to be exactly like you said, a belief based religion. It's supposed to be science of mind.
Right. Yeah.
And it is interesting.
It is interesting.
To read about this.
Yeah.
And so I kind of wanted to
follow that up.
Yeah, to immerse myself in that.
I think that's getting lost, though, in the amount of money and the way that it's administered. It seems like it's very...
You know, it actually, what's stunning about this is everybody would talk about the recruitment numbers. You know, there aren't that many people in Scientology, and it's dwindling all the time, but they are really rich. The church is really rich. One of the reasons they're rich is that their clergy works for free. These are the people, the young people you see, the Sea Org that you see in the uniforms. Young people, often, they work for free and they sign billion-year
contracts.
Labor contracts.
Yeah, right. So that as you keep coming back and reincarnating, you're still indentured.
Yeah. And so how you save the money. But
exactly.
But boy, in L.A. alone, at the time this book was written, which was 2012, 2013,
yeah,
they just bought a second television station, I think. $480-500 million worth of real estate holdings in Los Angeles alone. A couple of the most expensive and gloriously restored buildings in DuPont Circle, apartment buildings, nightclubs, hotels in Florida. So much stuff. Really good buildings on Times Square. Their real estate holdings are
top notch.
And they always get these places that are either in the midst of or about to get historic remodeling. Because isn't that true in Hollywood? You see all these beautiful buildings and you go, why does Scientology have that?
But, yeah.
Hey, at least the buildings look great.
Exactly. They're withholding the cultural heritage.
And finally, I've started to read something and I thought you might find this intriguing.
I might.
The screenplay for what is widely described as, if not the, one of the greatest movies never made. And that's the 156-page screenplay written by Stanley Kubrick, Napoleon.
Where did you get a copy of that now?
From...
secret sources?
From the PDF on my desk.
Wow. Now, I remember the Kubrick exhibit at
LACMA. And the research that he... the greatest library of books about Napoleon.
They had, like, his all original library with the credenza and everything in the gallery space. And you read his notes, and you read the production notes, and you see the photographs and the artwork he's working from, and you go, how did this not get made, and why did I not see this? And I don't think they actually explained it at the LACMA show, now that I think about it, why it fell apart. But, man, that looked like a great production.
I think it was budget. I think it was the cost of it, that Warner Brothers just would not sign off on.
Damn it.
Hey, let's do this.
Yes.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Important note for anyone who gets this. The Big and Tall Show, your comedy show in downtown Los Angeles, canceled for tonight.
Canceled tonight. They booked a private event this evening, so we are free to roam around the streets of Los Angeles doing random comedy at other venues.
But you might, yeah. So if you were planning to come downtown tonight,
right,
and you have enough time, but ordinarily... every Monday night, free comedy.
Yes.
Free. I said free with top-notch comics. These are people you know. These are people whose comedy you love. Their work on television, in radio. Radio?
Radio. I don't know. You love their work in radio.
You certainly tolerated.
Yes. You follow all their Twitter accounts. And now they're live.
So almost every Monday other than this, at the Lash Social in downtown Los Angeles.
Yes.
So if you need more details, write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
That's right.
We will be happy to help you out.
Point you on the way.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I start teaching my acting class tonight. That's a live event, and I'll report on that. I'm very excited. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Are you going to break them down? Are you going to make them cry? You're going to do that, aren't you? You're just going to...
Yeah, you know, I petitioned my dreams for a dream that I could share with the class.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a really good one.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was really, really good.
Psychotic? So, is it really psychotic?
What's odd is it was a dream about you being in Beverly Hills. And you're in Beverly Hills, I'm in Australia, and you burn yourself on a frying pan. You burn your hand on a frying pan in Beverly Hills, and at the exact same instant in Australia, I'm sitting up to my waist in a bowl of gravy. So I think clearly we understand it's that old chestnut.
Oh my gosh. I forgot that song, how that goes.
Hey, I attended, as I sometimes do.
Yes.
Easter services.
Oh.
Church at All Saints Beverly Hills, the Episcopal Church out there. And I always enjoy going, when I go, the rare occasions when I go, to hear the sermon of Steve Huber, the priest out there. Such a wordsmith.
Oh, really?
This guy. And when I say wordsmith, I mean not only a good writer and a good speaker, but the carefully, thoughtfully chosen word that will specifically resonate. And I always get a turn of phrase that I take away from this. And what he says, and how refreshing is this again? What I came away with was this phrase, that Jesus challenged everything in life that did not reflect love and dignity.
Ah, well, isn't that nice?
Challenged everything in life. Challenged. Not fought.
Right.
Like, because once you start to fight, you're no longer reflecting love and dignity.
Right. And you're bringing just challenge to
it. You know, and hearing this, and hearing a sermon that brings the metaphor to life, and what do I mean by that? Well, it means that you hear the metaphor and you say, or not fact doesn't matter. I can be this.
Right. I can extrapolate from whatever, however I interpret this metaphor.
And I can be it.
I can embody it.
And I want to, because that sounds groovy.
Right.
Right? And so I was thinking about, you know, the Episcopal Church in Los Angeles is very, very popular at a couple other places. But for the most part, in America, the Episcopal Church, much like apparently Scientology, only without the... Money. I was going to say without the real estate holdings, but the Episcopal Church owns some fantastic mansions and in condos Beverly in Beverly Hills. but they, because people give them,
donate them at the end of their lives.
But the Episcopal Church, the population is diminishing, and it struck me as, of course it is, when I was in this church service. And it was great, because we showed up a little bit late, but Lily's kind of a big deal, so they held for us. But we were way up in the back in the balconies, and it was kind of what I imagine my relationship to heaven will be like, if there's a heaven. And look, I'm willing. I'm not going to be an atheist. I'm not even going to be an agnostic. I'm willing to embrace the idea that there is, because I'm playing it safe. But if there is a heaven,
that's the ontological
department. I'm sure I'm going to arrive late.
Right.
I'm sure I'm going to be grudgingly allowed in, and only because I'm dropping someone's name. And I'm going to end up with really cheap seats.
Right.
And a bad view.
I can see that.
Anyway, it occurred to me, of course, the population of this is dwindling because we live in a time of such rigorous entrenchment.
Yes.
In a position. Rejection of religion. Fundamental interpretation of religion.
Right. Extreme.
That's something that lives in the layers, that lives in the metaphor.
Right. The in-betweenness.
Does not... stand a chance.
Yeah.
Doesn't really stand a chance, and is what makes it probably all the more important. I mean, again, some of the phrases talking about, you know, the resurrection being the introduction of another dimension into a certain perception of reality. He's talking quantum mechanics.
Wow. You never hear
and
that.
And the metaphor of it. And so, you know, I love this. Because for me, and we've talked about this before, it never was a debate between religion and science. Right. It's a debate between the science of now and the science of 2,000 years ago.
Right, and the metaphor of that and how we, interpret it now.
Anyway, I thought that that was really telling. And I also, I was thinking about these things in light of a study, I don't know if you saw, but this week a poll came out, and what was revealed was that Americans, a vast majority of Americans, by a large number, have a more favorable opinion of homosexuals than they do of evangelicals. And I thought, wow, you know, that's an interesting thing. And if I'm running election campaigns, that's information... I probably want to be paying attention to.
Yeah, for sure.
Isn't that
that's hilarious?
Interesting. Afterwards, I went and saw our own Lily Holloman and our friend Matt Doherty, who performed music all weekend at the Wallace, What's the Wallace Annenberg Performing Arts Center in Beverly Hills.
On that's over right behind the City Hall is now, right?
Right, and it's the old Public Works
Buildings,
post office that was restored lovingly as the foyer, as the entrance to this grand theater complex.
Fantastic.
And they perform music all weekend there.
All weekend?
Yeah.
So they were
Friday,
doing
Saturday, Sunday.
On stage they were, or just
on a stage, on an outdoor stage in the courtyard.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So that was great.
How fun was that?
Great, good fun. All right. We talked a lot about television news.
Yes.
Last week.
We did.
Any more X-Files developments that we need to comment upon?
The three of us, the Gunman boys, have been chatting. Bruce and Tom.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, yeah. We've been emailing us back and forth.
Good. I'd been wondering.
And then Bruce pointed it out. He goes, when were we ever the first to know anything?
Oh, no.
We were like literally, you know, even with our own spinoff, we were the last to know. So we would never know anything in advance now. Chances are we're in it, and we won't know till like 2 days before we have to be on set.
You know, I had this thought that for this deal to be set up, the scripts were all written. Clearly they're not, though they may be outlined in index cards, as we know that Chris and Frank work. But even Frank's deal hasn't been signed yet, Frank Spotnitz. But, of course, in his interview with X-Files News, Chris Carter, of March 25th,
right.
Chris Carter talked about how it's going to be different writers writing each of the episodes, and they're going to try to go get other writers, like Morgan and Wong, though they have to be let out of another contract to do it. So clearly these scripts are not written, even though this goes into production in June.
I know. And this is
so there's a lot of moving parts.
A lot of moving parts. And, you know, considering Twin Peaks just went up, upended itself.
You just suddenly jumped ahead on our itinerary.
We talked about it
last week.
We did.
And we laid the groundwork for this. Everybody getting so excited. And what he said in Australia, what did I say? That the ultimate game of chicken of negotiation is going on. So now everyone says that it's off, though it's not off. David Lynch, for those who don't know, wrote a letter to the Twin Peaks Festival people. His production office did this. And the first thing he said is, it's not off. Showtime has not pulled the plug.
Right.
And it's that he will not be directing them because they're not giving him enough money.
Right.
To, according to him, do the scripts justice. Now, that doesn't say budget, that you're arguing over budget.
Right.
They're not paying him enough to do
the scripts, but
you're not paying me enough money to do my job right, which is fascinating. So depending on how much you get paid, you half-ass things. I don't know. but anyway, and he wrote in this that he'd contacted the actors to let them know that he was not going to be a part of it. But as far as he knew, it was still moving forward, and he wished them all well because he loves the world of Twin Peaks. After all, he's co-written all the episodes that are already written.
Right. So
they are scripted and written.
They got his hand on it.
Is he going to be directing it? And I, as you know, the reason that I had hope for this was because, like with True Detective, this had the chance to be the directorial presence of one person.
Right.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's very rare in television. But that's interesting. And also, Twin Peaks originally suffered so much from him abandoning it.
Yeah.
And doesn't that smack of exactly what he's doing again?
Exactly. And I think that would be a negotiation ploy.
And it is. But it's stunning to me that they hadn't agreed to a deal. They must have agreed to a deal, but I can't know that. Because how do you announce it without having him? And he's going to direct every episode.
Yeah.
Unless you've signed that contract already. But maybe they didn't, and maybe it was considered a fait accompli. And, but man, I got to tell you, if I'm Showtime, much as I'm on the side of wanting Twin Peaks to be good, if I'm Showtime, I call his bluff.
Yeah.
Because you know what? As a Twin Peaks fan, because for him to release this as a statement directly to the festival, directly to the fans, what does that say? To me, that says, I want you all to gang up on Showtime and send their dismay. We won't watch this without David Lynch.
Right, this
we
is the
need
pressure.
David Lynch. He's a genius. Do this.
But I think, but then Showtime's example. Did you read Forbes magazine about the analysis of X-Files while that's coming back? Has nothing to do with fan pressure whatsoever. What it has to do with is your Netflix deal.
Right.
And your Netflix deal needs more than a rerun deal. And it needs a closer. They want to have an arc so the fans will watch it from beginning to a closed end, whereas network could leave it open-ended in case they wanted to do another season.
So they know what basically their profit margin
exactly
is.
So Netflix is giving them an X amount of dollars to film another six, like The X-Files, and film another six, like Twin Peaks, so that everybody who watches, binge watches on Netflix, will watch something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so you can then take old inventory, put an end to it, and repurpose it and get your profit.
Like
10
we
times
talked
over.
About, the Twin X-Files is not available on Blu-ray.
Exactly.
Yet. I would imagine by Christmas time.
Once your six are up.
Yeah. When we have an ending. And then if it's really successful, of course they'll come back and do another limited run.
Yeah, for sure.
I always heard that House of Cards was going to be three seasons, and now we're already picked up for a fourth season.
Right.
Or it's like the old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books. You know. It's like part five of our ever-increasing trilogy.
Yes, totally. Exactly. Well, and it's like my relationship with Mad Men. I'm going to let that thing run out to the end. Then sit down and watch them all, because I know I would love the show. I haven't seen a single episode of it yet.
Well, and that's certainly better than watching last season without its conclusion, because this show was always one, Mad Men, where you started the season going, oh, they've really dropped the ball, because it's such a different show each year,
right?
Because they're jumping years in
exactly,
time.
And they're doing
and then it always takes several episodes before you go, oh, wait, I get what they're on to.
Yeah.
And that's right around the middle of the season. And then by the end of the season, what you've seen is so terrific that all the hard work you've had to do as a viewer pays off.
See?
But last year, you know what they did? They split the final season into two, so they ended with the episode where you're finally starting to understand what they're up to, but there's no payoff. So consequently, a lot of people said, boy, they've really lost it, because the audience didn't know that they'd split the season into.
Oh, right. See? And I won't have to worry about that.
You won't.
When I watch
You'll be able
all,
to watch it as
all
is. I'll
kick my feet up in a hammock and let them rip.
But again, if I'm Showtime, then especially because I know the profit margin on this,
and it's X. You know, there's no variant. There's no X number of hits, you get more money from Netflix. Netflix pays a flat fee, give us the shows, and then whatever.
And I would do that. I would say, you know, you've spent these years writing this, and the actors are on board. And, you know, you had a lot of relationship damage to patch up with those actors who felt betrayed and angry about that betrayal
right. The
first time around. And you're going to do it again? Okay, do it again.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where's your leverage now?
Yeah, you won't have any.
Yeah, I mean, all you've got are angry Twin Peaks fans. No one else in this town has given a damn about Twin Peaks fans
ever
since that failed movie you made.
Right.
So,
and the failed movie was only a hard attempt to get these Twin Peaks fans you heard about into the box office.
Lynch, who had abandoned his
thing
before.
Yeah.
And also made a movie that was a prequel that, although it is a good movie, I've come around on it, as you know, and I realize it's a good movie. But I judged it through the prism of Twin Peaks, and I'm still not sure it was good Twin Peaks. And indeed, it revealed that, boy, Lynch hasn't watched the pilot movie recently, because there's things that contradict here.
Is that right?
Yeah. Let alone certainly didn't watch what followed. Anyway.
Speaking of Netflix, man. What movie was that, by the way?
Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me?
Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah. Netflix.
Yes.
The big news that really excited me was Bob Odenkirk and David Cross
coming back,
reteaming for the first time since the 90s. The old Mr. Show guys are going to be doing four episodes of sketch comedy on Netflix.
Can you imagine? I think that would be really great. I mean, I loved Mr. Show. My favorite was the how it all intersected. Like, it was like this sketch walked into that sketch that then called back to a sketch three sketches ago.
And you tell me, I mean, as you have grown as an actor, now your sketch comedy is often improvisational and it's often one man, but and maybe this applies even in those circumstances. But as you have grown as an actor, have you found that your performance in sketch comedy and in improv comedy has deepened as well because you've grown as an actor?
Yeah, absolutely. And you want to bring more layers to it, because once you go, oh, here's a funny single joke, and you can, you know, produce it well and nail it and go, oh yeah, well, there, that was your single joke. And then you want to start adding layers, like commentary, political insight, parody, spoof, like all that, all within the same sketch. So I'm hoping that these guys bring in an already multi-layered sketch show like Mr. Show, step up it even more, if that's possible.
We pre-recorded an episode last week.
We did.
That we'll play at some point, that was about our all-time favorite funny ladies.
Yes.
And so that's coming up, and that's a really good show. But one name that I had totally not occurred to me, and for the first time I started watching Modern Family.
I actually
never watched Modern Family. I mean, I'd watched a few minutes, and I appreciated it, but, you know, these pseudo-documentary shows, like, who's interviewing them, and when do they get enough footage for their documentary?
I know, but, like The Office.
But I can't believe I left Julie Bowen
off.
Because here's a woman who just gets more and more beautiful and more funny.
She was great on Boston Legal.
Ed. So we were talking about Mary Tyler Moore. That's the antecedent I want to talk about. Here's Mary Tyler Moore, who, as she matures, gets better and better and funnier and funnier and more of a brilliant ensemble player.
Yep.
That's what's happened with Julie Bowen when she was young and kind of an ingenue in Ed and then in Boston Legal and now in Modern Family.
And just bringing...
She's a treasure. She's certainly the modern equivalent is Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, for sure. Because she brings not only the comedic talent, but she plays the drunk, light drunk, really funny, which is so hard to do. You know, because other people either overplay it, but her tipsy comedy is hilarious.
And you know what I love about Julia Louis-Dreyfus is that you're always kind of rooting against her, even as you're rooting for her.
Yeah, exactly.
You're kind of rooting against her for things to go wrong. Julie Bowen, even though you know everything's going to go wrong, you kind of are rooting for her. You really, her pain touches you.
Yeah, right? She's bringing actual emotional vulnerability.
I mean, she's kind of the light to the dark of Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Think of the two of them in a series.
Oh, my God.
Wow, that'd be comedy.
Contact the networks. Well, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is doing that that Force Majeure remake we talked about.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to remember. There is another wife role, I think, in it. Maybe we get Julie Bowen.
Come on.
Boy, people listen to this show, and that's,
you know, they do. That's how all casting takes place.
Our listeners may not be legion, but they are mighty. So last week we had an email from a listener, which was about using Beyond Pod podcast reader on his Android phone and finding that via the RSS feed, the downloaded file for each episode is advertised to be 5 to 6 hours long.
Right.
You guys are there in each file and speaking okay and everything. However, the feature to return to last played position, or doing a little fast forward or reverse, everything gets all messed up.
Damn
and
it.
He can literally hear us speak the same words at various time spots in the file.
Aha, so it's repeating.
So anyway, yours is the only podcast I listen to that I've seen this, and I'd love for you to double check and confirm maybe some obscure settings. All right. So since then, everyone who uses iTunes has been getting in touch with me saying it is the same thing on iTunes, the same problem.
5 to 6 hours.
Yeah, or 4 hours, and that they can't go back to the same position. So I forwarded Tom's email.
Yes.
And also said this is true of iTunes as well.
Right.
And Sherry Sandland was kind enough to reply.
Yes.
She said, hi there. Thanks for writing in. You will need to contact iTunes support to find out what is happening. It looks like your iTunes feed is not coming in through your Blog Talk Radio account. It is feeding to iTunes from your website. If you have a different iTunes feed from Blog Talk Radio, can you please send us the link? Regards, Sherry. Sherry Sandlin, Assistant Director of Passing the Buck, blogtalkradio.com. And I say that. I make that little
glib
side joke, Sherry. Because I then said, okay, but what about the guy's original question, which is the RSS feed?
Right, which is
that
coming
us or Blog Talk Radio?
Well, we don't build an RSS feed.
Yeah,
we only get that information from our server.
So I asked that question, and it's as if I've demanded silence.
Oh,
so there we go. So we are looking into it, and hang with
mysterious.
Us. Hang with us. By the time Dean is back from Australia in a couple years, we will have this figured out.
It'll be fine.
Of course, by then we'll just be dropping it directly into that Chill Back Hollywood Hour chip that you have implanted in your brain.
Yes, we're all wet-wired.
Well,
that's going to be the term.
That's your autobiography. Yes, we're all wet wired. All right, finally, you know, we used to talk about movies on this show.
Yes,
boy, I have
that?
A lot to talk about, but I would imagine
movies.
That you saw some on your long plane flights. Did you not?
I did. We talked about a few of them. And
did
now,
we?
Yes.
I don't think we have.
Big Eyes, I saw. Well, I saw that in Australian theater.
You haven't talked about that at all?
What?
No.
I thought we talked about this.
No, we didn't talk about movies last week, and we're not doing it now because you're asking me whether we talked about it last week.
Okay, you hated Big Eyes. I loved it.
Boy, I hated it.
I loved it. I thought it was, I mean, I didn't like Tim Burton's, I mean, it was the lightest Tim Burton direction I've ever seen. Like, other than the...
I wanted a real depiction of that story. I didn't want a phony depiction of that story. That's an interesting story.
Yeah.
I didn't want bad actors giving bad performances.
Who was bad acting?
Okay, Christoph Waltz is so over the top.
The guy himself.
And the next time, Amy Adams is believable will be the first time that Amy Adams is believable.
I thought this was the best Amy Adams the thing she's ever done, frankly. I thought she underplayed everything lovelily, not over... Or, well, you know.
I found also, you know, I'm not sure a movie about spousal abuse ought to have the most lighthearted tone.
Okay, I don't think those scenes were lighthearted. How did you see lighthearted in throwing
I didn't say that those scenes did.
You thought the tone of the movie was lighthearted.
The tone of the movie is very lighthearted.
Only because it was trying to capture the kitsch of the art itself. So you're stuck.
Well, okay, so you know the reason. So you've just named the reason why the movie doesn't work. Congratulations. Is there any way else you can help me in my case, Dean Haglund? But then again, you know, Jesus challenged anything that did not reflect love and dignity in life. You loved it, and I
challenge it.
And I dignify your love of it with this response.
You're an idiot.
You're wrong.
Ah, fantastic.
No, well, that's good.
I like the story. I mean, you know, and in terms of... for me, the dichotomy between being creative in a solo thing and also having to be out there promoting your artwork, being on Instagram, like I'm way behind on all of that stuff. All of these things are equally as important to your success as an artist as much as slaving away 16 to 18 hours
Absolutely.
In your studio. So to me, this movie was the interior monologue that I have going on every day,
right.
Which is why it resonated probably so much more for me than perhaps for you.
Or for audiences, because again, you can understand why it resonated so much for Tim Burton and why he made it, and therefore also why, other than maybe what, like Ed Wood, it's his least successful, right? Because it's going to be a limited
audience. Yeah, it has a limited appeal to a person like me who's going through that dilemma.
But I see what I thought, why I thought Ed Wood was his best work was... that it actually was a movie that embodied the spirit of Ed Wood.
Right.
And
this didn't embody...
And this was tough. This was embodying the spirit of Tim Burton.
Yes, which is the dichotomy between...
And I feel like you really needed to tie to one of their point of views, not both of them.
You can't play both. Right, because at times you're following her and at times you're in with him.
Yeah, it was tough. But anyway,
tough.
But see, we just made the film, by the way, more interesting, I think, than for most people they thought it was, right? Because people stayed away from it. Was there any interesting advertising campaign about this at all?
No, and in fact, they would show the one or two scenes with people with super large eyes, like in the
You wouldn't get any sense. Like, it's a Tim Burton film like Beetlejuice.
Right, so that's crazy.
No,
but it wasn't like that at all.
It was from the mind. Of Tim Burton that said, no, actually, from the pages of history
right,
comes
exactly.
a real story.
A real story, a true
that he
story.
He cares about. So that was weird.
Yeah.
That really was weird. So it'll be interesting what happens to this film as people are actually able to discover it.
Yes.
Through the years. Because you know, with Tim Burton involved and Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, this is not a movie that gets utterly forgotten.
Right.
Right? So it'll be interesting to see what the conversation is around it.
Yeah.
What else did you see?
Oh, my gosh. Have you ever seen this Tommy Lee Jones, Hilary Swank?
Holmesman, I talked about this on the show. That was, may have made my list as one of the worst movies of the year. Yeah.
I saw this on the plane, and it literally... took the wind out of my limited airspace that I had.
It begins kind of interesting.
Kind of interesting.
When she's trying to attract a husband on the plains.
With her large amount of salary and her successful farms and stuff like that.
And then it becomes this somewhat palatable, odd couple road comedy.
Comedy where they're taking mentally infirmed women away from their homesteads to a church on the east coast.
So that's a little dark. And then a turn where...
the third act... The start of the third act.
It stops being about the person that the movie's about.
Yeah.
And then it becomes about the director of the movie.
And even then, it's like he is now just so... I don't know if he's so angry at the tone or the direction the movie's taken that he becomes like way more angry a character. Like he becomes darker and darker when he's supposed to be redeeming himself by carrying these women to the church.
And it's so funny because they use the Coen brothers... crew, and they helped with this, and it was like, okay, maybe the Coen brothers could have done something with this.
Right.
They used a lot of Lincoln sets, and they even have James Spader show up still in his Lincoln outfit.
I know. I thought that was the same wardrobe.
You know, it's so distracting. Anyway, yeah, that movie is appallingly bad.
Appallingly bad, with Meryl Streep, James Spader, Hilary Swank, Tommy Lee Jones. It's got like a plethora.
And you understand why Hilary Swank does it, because how many roles is she offered, and how many roles is she offered that gives her something interesting?
Exactly.
And there are interesting scenes in that for her.
For sure.
But boy,
dark in hell, holy smokes. I don't even remember this being in theaters.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw it, but anyway.
Wow, yeah. Anyway, and then Nightcrawler, of course, I finally got to.
Oh, you finally got to this.
Finally got to.
And what do we think?
The darkest comedy.
Yes.
You're laughing.
Not
a thriller.
Not marketed as a dark comedy at all.
No, because it's so black, if you're laughing at it, you may think you have something wrong with
you.
And
yet, such the perfect commentary on media and our culture and how we got here and where we're going. And I saw so many, I went and saw this multiple times. And always with an industry crowd. And afterwards, it was always like, well, yeah, his performance is brilliant, but the character is unredeemed. The film is unredeemable. And it's like, well, did you understand it was a dark comedy?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't sold as a dark comedy. Nobody told me it was a dark comedy, which gets back to the problem with like our movie, The Lady Killers. How do you give people permission to laugh?
Yes.
Which is why dark comedies often fail on initial release, but then get discovered.
Right.
And
when everybody goes, oh, you can laugh at this, and then you can go in and have it in a personal setting. Whereas I don't know if I'd be laughing in a large theater at that one, frankly.
I was. I mean, boy, his last... I mean,
that final speech.
Every speech that Jake Gyllenhaal, who plays... the Nightcrawler is a nighttime news
stringer
who goes out and films footage and then of potential news stories, the kind of stories, if it bleeds, it leads, and then sells them to local stations. So he's an independent news gatherer. And he has an employee who's working for free, basically, for a long time. And his pep talks... to that guy throughout it are
so
hilarious.
And dead on.
Every time he has a speech with someone else, like everything with Rene Russo, it's creepy, but man, it's funny.
Yeah, and it comes straight from these, Tony Robbins' How to Manage Successfully books, like all of that talk that he's using to the darkest ends. So funny. I loved it.
I've seen a lot.
Okay,
Lot of movies. I mentioned The Furious Seven.
Yes.
From director James Wan, who, of course, in addition to the Saw movies, did the very good The Conjuring.
Oh yeah.
And it's so odd because it almost strikes me that the director doesn't understand English in how off the timing is. I don't understand how the reviews are so good for this one.
Because our love of Paul Walker. And
well, everything is context, right?
Right.
I mean, I saw another movie this weekend, same crowd at the DGA, The Water Diviner. And is Russell Crowe's directorial debut.
Right.
And what you get out of it is, boy, if an A-list actor had to have directed Unbroken, it should have been him and not Angelina Jolie.
Ah.
And I shared that with Lily, and she said, that's amazing you would say that, because halfway through The Water Diviner, I was ready to call it Unbroken 2. And even though what it really is like a sequel to Gallipoli, a sequel to Lawrence of Arabia, a sequel to all these movies that Russell Crowe clearly loved.
Right.
He throws a lot into it, well-intentioned, and there are sections of the movie, like 20-minute, 30-minute sections, where you really like the movie.
Ah.
You're not saying it's a great movie, but you're really liking it. It's a movie you really root for.
Awesome.
Not just the character, you root for the movie. And in some ways, it pays off very nicely. In other ways, it doesn't. Mm. Did I mention he's a first-time director?
Right.
It looks like the film of a first-time director. Not a first-time director without talent, but a first-time director.
Right.
And but anyway, but he really would have brought something wonderful
to
the actual true story of Louis Zamperini in Unbroken. But this story ultimately never smacks of true. It smacks too much of moments that I've loved in other movies. And isn't that often a description of filmmakers early on in their in their careers? But James Wan, anyway, this movie, The Water Diviner, again, a movie about love, you're always going to be challenged with the critics. But, you know, the reviews have been okay. They've been decent. They've been kind even when people have rejected the movie. But the reviews for Furious 7 have been much, much better.
Yeah.
And yet The Water Diviner actually, is a movie that has things to recommend it, as opposed to Furious 7 that has nothing to recommend it.
No, it's more fast cars driving around.
But it's always context, right?
Right.
There was the Roger Ebert documentary, Life Itself, that I watched. With Steve, directed by Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams.
Right.
And they showed one of the classic arguments from Siskel and Ebert on one of the shows. And I think, don't
quote you on this.
Quote me on this. But it was something along the lines of they got in a huge disagreement over Blue Velvet.
Right.
Siskel loved it.
Yes.
Ebert hated it. And then later in the show, there's a movie about like a dog that talks. And Siskel hated it, and Ebert recommended it. Thumbs up. And Siskel hits him with...
How?
Wait a minute. So you're saying the movie about the dog that talks is better than Blue Velvet, which you trashed. And Ebert gets irate with him. How dare you? Shame on you for saying that, Gene Siskel, because you know that it's all about context. You know that it is. Is it? And how much of it should be?
Right.
I mean, I agree that Furious 7 is getting much better reviews because maybe it's the best of the Fast and the Furious movies, and people love them.
Right.
Do we review James Bond movies as movies, or do we review them as James Bond movies?
Right.
That gets back to that John Simon conversation we were having. But I really, even when I could appreciate what they were doing or some of the things, and also in the context of knowing that you have a lead actor who dies 14 days into his 27 days of work.
Right.
So now you have to rewrite, reconfigure everything when that's the lead actor.
And did you...
And they did a nice job of reworking the story. It all becomes about Vin Diesel as the lead.
Uh-huh.
And you're not aware of why is Paul Walker not on the screen right now? Why is this?
Oh, good.
But, you know, and honestly... These things are probably so cookie cutter and so pre-planned by marketing departments that probably did elevate it because it forced them into a place of creativity.
Right. Yeah, where you're limited now.
But, it's going to be a huge hit and it's going to be pre-sold internationally. But I walked out of this. I mean, I felt lightheaded. I felt dizzy. there's no grounding it in anything
right.
at all. And so it was... It was really, really disturbing. let me hit you with a few other things. One thing I revisited, because we'd been talking about Godard. Did you ever catch?
No.
It played all month.
I know, all month. You just told me the last week.
I told you before when it was coming to the Downtown Independent, and then when I was there last week, I said it's still extended.
Still there for
so it played
four more
for
days.
A month, the 3D Goodbye to Language.
I know.
Jean-Luc Godard. Anyway, and we talked about how Alphaville is going to be remade, so I went back and I watched... Alphaville.
Oh, you did?
With Eddie Constantine, expat actor Eddie Constantine, as spy Lemmy Caution. And Lemmy Caution was a character he played in like a handful of B French movies.
Yes.
And then Godard said, I want to do one, but we're going to set it in an unnamed future, in another universe called Alphaville. And it's so weird, but man, it is so much fun. And anyway, and I just wanted to mention this because I started looking looking up. I knew the band Alphaville. I knew Brian Ferry did a song, Alphaville. And I was thinking of all the tributes to this movie in one way or another. But my favorite is that, like, the most high-priced, high-end suburb of Sao Paulo, Brazil, is named Alphaville
for the movie
as a tribute to the movie. Can you imagine naming your neighborhood after a place where emotion is outlawed?
Dystopian future.
I love it.
That's awesome.
I love it. I saw Cinderella. End of conversation there.
Yeah, I would think so. What were you doing?
Yeah. And again, in context, it's, you know, I can understand why reviewers are liking it. It's Kenneth Branagh. It's well enough done. The young lady who plays Cinderella is fine. But you know what? There is no sense of whimsy or magic to it whatsoever. Why do you need it?
I don't understand. What is it resonating in our society? What context? How did anybody go, oh, we have to make this
movie? But it's
a big
hit. I mean, and that's why. And that's why, because they knew it would make money, because everyone wants to be a princess.
That's where it's resonating.
I saw two independent comedies that I've... Well, one I saw a while back, and I've never spoken of it.
Oh, dear.
But it's our friend Matt Giles, one of his favorite movies of the year, and he was outraged that more critics didn't mention it or champion it or have it on its list. And it's a movie called Listen Up, Philip, from writer-director Alex Ross Perry, and it stars Jason Schwartzman and Elizabeth Moss.
They're funny.
And Jonathan Pryce. And Jason Schwartzman plays a very egomaniacal novelist, young novelist, and it's about his friendship with this older, really not misogynist necessarily, but someone who's soured on all of life, right? This writer who's very successful but very much a miscreant, and their relationship. And the script is very funny, and some of the performers are very funny. And you watch the movie, seeing the writing, and you go, wow, this is good. Why isn't this good?
Right.
And this is a great movie to watch if you want to know what directors do to either make a movie or unmake a movie or ruin
a movie.
Because the direction is uniformly terrible. And as a writer, Alex Ross Perry is so far ahead of where he is as a director, and this happens.
Right.
But he's emulating, obviously, people as a writer. It seems like a Woody Allen script. It seems like a Wes Anderson script, but a well-written Woody Allen and Wes Anderson script.
Fantastic.
And the thing is, It would have been great. Wes Anderson's even thanked. He gets special thanks. Have Wes Anderson or Woody Allen direct it. Can you imagine Woody Allen directing someone else's script? Isn't that exactly what he needs as a director?
Totally.
And Woody Allen making this would have been brilliant. But don't, if you're going to use that tone and you're going to cast
big names,
frequent Wes Anderson collaborator Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be careful about it. But instead, he wants to be John Cassavetes, and he emulates that style. It's shot like Faces, and it doesn't work. And this is why, Maddie, the movie, especially in theaters, suffered dramatically, where people gave it good reviews, but nobody championed it. Nobody loved it, because it really was undermined by the approach to the material.
Ha.
A great movie could have been made of this.
Damn it.
And I think everybody was pretty much aware of it. There's another indie comedy that I finally caught up with that critics liked a great deal and film festival audiences, called Dear White People.
Yeah.
From Justin Simien and Adriana Serrano. And it stars Tessa Thompson, who I've seen at the Pasadena Playhouse in Boston Court. She's a local theater actress.
Right.
It stars Brandon Bell and the amazing Tyler James Williams, who I guess is on Walking Dead
now.
And think of it as like a 2014 School Days, that Spike Lee movie.
Yeah.
And this movie's a mess. It is a mess, and I loved it.
Spike Lee mess.
No, not a Spike Lee mess, because a Spike Lee mess, I think they're called Spike Lee joints.
Yeah.
But a Spike Lee mess expresses Spike Lee's worldview.
Yes.
And his society view, which is fine, and when it works, it's great, right?
Right.
And he has a very specific point of view. This movie is about what is it like to be black in America. That's your topic.
Uh-huh.
A movie like that is going to be a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
Because where's the specificity in that?
Yeah.
And it sets that question on a Ivy League college campus.
Cool.
Now that's an interesting
concept. That's a good one.
And but so yes, it's all over the map, and sometimes tonally there's shifts, and sometimes pacing wise there's problems. But you really are interested in all of these characters and all of their, and what you come away with is not an easy answer at all, which is, what is it like to be black in America?
That's
ask
not
the individual.
Right.
Because
it's not a group thing.
It is not a group thing.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to start understanding, both as white people and as black people.
Absolutely.
So it's a movie that I loved, even when it didn't work, because they took on something that couldn't work, but was nevertheless important.
Right.
And isn't that one of the purposes of art?
Yeah.
And entertainment. Take on things that you can't accomplish. Let your reach exceed your grasp.
Absolutely.
Because the failure is going to be exciting. And maybe, to a degree, that's why, one of the reasons, not to knock it, but maybe that very thing is one of the reasons that you found Big Eyes so appealing. Because Tim Burton was
reaching
beyond his grasp.
Could very well
be. You've knocked Tim Burton before.
Many
for
a
kind
time.
Of staying in a safety
zone. Thing, yes.
So
there you go.
Finally, almost a year after I saw one of our favorite films of the year, it's easy to forget that Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel came out in March of last year. Because great movies do come out earlier and earlier. I saw Clouds of Sils Maria. Oliver Assayas's new film, and it's in French and English and other language. It stars Juliette Binoche, Kirsten Stewart, who it was nominated for many César Awards, the French Oscars last year. Kirsten Stewart from the Twilight movies became only the second American ever to win a César Award.
What?
The first was Adrian Brody for The Pianist.
Holy cool.
And Juliette Binoche, boy, Juliette Binoche is a great actress, and I think we overlook what a great actress she is. I mean, she's almost at that level of being Liv Ullmann legendary.
Wow,
you know, and someday will be that. And so it was stunning because it was almost like seeing Ingmar Bergman come and make a great female-driven movie about these actresses and about what maturing does to women, especially when how they appear is what is interacted with first. It basically focuses on this famous actress of movies and films who broke through with a particular role when she was 20 years old. And the writer of that piece and the playwright has died, and she finds out that he's died when she's heading to Switzerland to present him this award. And there, a young director says, you know, we're doing this with the permission of the widow, this revival, and we would like you to play the older woman's part now. You've done that. Would it be great to do this? And what this does to her psyche, having to let go of her images. It's very much like Persona. Or what was it, Cries and Whispers,
yes.
the Ingmar Bergman films. And Oliver Assayas is really a fantastic filmmaker. He did Irma Vep with Maggie Cheung playing herself.
Oh, well.
You know,
back when.
About the making of a vampire film.
Yeah.
And the cinematography is terrific. But if you want to see a female-driven picture with rich depictions of many women, you know, it just, God, the movie got better and better and better. It's an early front runner for Best Picture of the Year for me. And I will champion this movie probably again and again and again because of no other reason than everyone in this town talks about how there aren't enough roles for women.
Right.
I see an industry screening of it at the DGA, packed for Furious 7, more than half of the audience women. Here's a great female-driven movie that's won so many international awards.
Right.
Damn near empty. More men than women.
Yeah.
So seek out movies. If you want movies by different voices, starring different voices, seek them out.
Be
and
the
support
change.
Them and champion. Find a
Absolutely.
Way to champion them. That brings us to an end of another installment of your Chilpack Hollywood.
You can find so many episodes on our website at chilpackhollywood.com. You can stream us. You can download us. You can figure out that RSS feed somehow.
Yeah.
We'll figure that out.
Chilpackhollywood.com.
Yeah.
Also,
Facebook.
Like us on Facebook.
Yes.
Facebook.com/ChilpackHollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And follow us on Twitter.
We're at Dean and Phil. So easy.
And until next week.
I'm Dean Haglund.
And I'm Phil Lairness. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.